I ask that because, we are all Keynesians now. If COVID-19 has done one thing, it's to wed governments worldwide to that idea of stimulus. If it can work here, well, you can be certain it's working in a lot of other places as well. It used to be in that now vanished world of neoliberal austerity. Stimulus was such a dirty word. Now, we attach his name to that idea of economic stimulus, but what do we really know about John Maynard Keynes, dead since 1945? To borrow the great Robert Hughes's words on Caravaggio, there was macroeconomics before Keynes, there was macroeconomics after Keynes, but they were not the same. Keynes, of course, was a dab hand at a quote himself, one I rather like. In the long run, we're all dead. Economic historian Alex Milmau joins us. So, and we're going to ask of Alex, what would Keynes do now? And what have others done, perhaps following his example, in the great economic crises past, the Great Depression of the 1930s, Reconstruction after World War II, the oil shock of the 1970s? Alex is Associate Professor of Economics at Federation Business School in Melbourne. Welcome to LNL, Alex.
Good day, Jonathan.
So fill us in. A rough summary of this Keynesian idea. What are Keynesian policies?
Well, Keynes was this English don who lived through the Great Depression, and he came up with the theoretical justification for intervention for the public sector, for the state to enter in and rescue the economy from the doldrums, from the massive unemployment and despair that afflicted most Western economies in the 1930s.
What did he have to fight to get that idea up?
Persuasion, ideas, rhetoric. He was fighting against an orthodox treasury that believed in balanced budgets and believed that you should leave the economy alone, laissez-faire, the doctrine of laissez-faire. So Keynes' revolution was a theoretical one, but also a public policy one, that the state should enter into saving the economy as we're seeing tonight with the Scott Morrison government and other countries overseas.
Did it work for him then?
During that
Great Depression?
Not initially. There was a lot of inertia and rigidity. It was only the war that basically brought Keynesian economics to the fore, because then countries had to fight an emergency. It was fighting the Nazis or the Japanese, and so they had to have these massive state intervention, manpower regulation, mobilization of resources. So that's how Keynesian economics actually was born. But there were some early experiments of Keynesian economics in Australia and also in Sweden. In Britain, his homeland, there was a sort of resistance to his conceptual approach. But Keynes was actually in the Treasury during the war, and he actually was, by then a great economic statesman, and countries basically all became Keynesian, including America. Roosevelt met Keynes in 1933, but both of them were not too impressed by the either. But Roosevelt's New Deal was quasi-Keynesian, but it was also a little bit of pragmatic politics, expedient politics to rescue the American economy from the doldrums.
But like the Keynesian sort of inputs, as you say, around the time of the beginning of the Second World War, I mean, the New Deal was quite late to the party as well.
It was, and some economists say that it wasn't Keynesian at all and it wasn't strong enough, but at least that Roosevelt marshaled resources to getting America out of the slump. But again, it was the war that brought America into the full employment economy. In Australia, even by 1939, we still had a 9% unemployment figure. Even though the economists advising the Australian government on and off were all by then fairly Keynesian, they were persuaded by the great economist of Keynes, that he had a new theoretical revolution, and they discarded their old economics, the old economic framework of managing the economy. So Keynes was basically an economic statesman. But Keynesian economics only came to roost basic during World War II and on an aftermath.
That Great Depression of the 30s, I mean, the reference has been constantly made in recent weeks as we watch exchanges crash. Is this what we are seeing now, the biggest crisis since that Great Depression?
I would wager it probably is. I think I've seen some major economic figures like Joe Stiglitz saying that. And it's still unravelling, still unfolding. We don't know where it's going, but it is the greatest crisis of capitalism since the 1930s. The stagflation period of the 1970s, the oil price crisis, they look pretty lowly now. What about the global financial crisis? That was more a financial crisis by
chicken feed.
Bankers. Yeah, chicken feed. It was, but this really is the mother of all crises, if you want. I must tell you a little joke here at this point. Every Easter, the Marxists in Melbourne have an annual conference where they talk about the demise of capitalism, the demise of neoliberalism. Well, this year their conference has been cancelled, not because of ideological reasons, but just because of too many people in the one place. You know, they're not allowed to gather.
Sneaking suspicion that the job's done.
The moment has come, but it's been snatched away by these regulations put in by the government.
This is a really interesting thing about the current difficulties, and you mentioned the GFC, which of course confronted Kevin Rudd, a Labor Prime Minister.
Yeah,
this is the first, in Australian terms, the first crisis to baffle a Conservative government, a coalition government. In the Great Depression, we had Prime Minister Scullin had the great misfortune to be elected 2 weeks before the Wall Street crash.
That's right.
Whitlam also had the oil price shock crisis of 1974.
Yep. There's a delicious historical twist here. The Scullin government put in all the right formula that the economists were saying, you know, balance the budget, have a wage cut, devalue the pound, devalue the Australian pound, put in all the hard yards, put in the reconstruction measures. Australia had to basically cut back its spending because we had borrowed that much. We couldn't engage in excessive government spending or public works. The Scullin government was annihilated 10 months after they put in the Premier's plan. And now Scott Morrison's government, having run up the credit card, is going to have to, you know, figure out how are they going to actually pay this massive amount of stimulus.
I think Morris
said 15% of GDP. Yeah. 15% of GDP. How are they going to pay the ferrymen? They will have to invent new taxes. They'll have to bring back the carbon tax, the mining tax. They'll have to cut back all these tax expenditures, you know, the loophole with like negative gearing, the discount on capital gains tax, franking credits.
That was a question that, of course, consumed Keynes as well, the question of, well, how do we pay for it?
Well, he said that growth would pay for it, but in this case, these are emergency measures. We're actually trying to save the Australian economy from liquidation, from basically going into the Stone Age. These are emergency wartime measures. Keynes would have been much more blasé. Well, Keynes was fairly blasé. Growth will pay the fiscal dividend, will bring back the tax revenue. But the amount of spending done by the Morrison government, which is quite justifiable, it will mean more tax burdens down the track in two or three years. We'll have to pay for it. We'll be generations away from a surplus. And only 5 weeks ago, we were actually heading towards that surplus. The Wall Street started to tremble 5 weeks ago, this Monday night, 5 weeks ago. So the Freudenberg's budget surplus has been snatched away from, and we're going to be in deep red for the next 15 years at least.
And he will, for the rest of his life, sit there rocking in his chair on that porch saying, I was so close.
He got so close, but he's won a better prize. The better prize is to save the economic
Let's go back.
Much better as a treasurer that than to have a silly surplus, which doesn't really matter to anyone.
Let's go back. You mentioned the Premier's plan, 1931, back in the Great Depression. Tell us about that, because that is a really tricky part of politics in this country.
Well, the Depression was slow building. Australia basically was exporting wool and wheat, and the prices were falling down from about 1927. We'd borrow a lot of foreign money from London to engage in infrastructure and capital works, and we had to pay back the interest on that, plus the principal. And at the same time, our export prices were slumping. So we were caught in this bind. And then there was the small market, Wall Street collapsed, and then countries started to turn to protectionism, and Australia was caught short. The only thing we could do was to balance the budget, have a wage cut, devalue the pound, have an income cut across all classes of society, a little bit what we're doing today, to get out of the mess. What happened then was we had a long traverse out of that depression. for about 5 years, unemployment was in double digit. At one stage, 1932, it was 20%. So we had a long entry into the depression and a long exit out. By 1935, we were coming out. But even then, we still had about 8%, 9% unemployment. And it really had a strong impact upon people, upon intellectuals, upon politicians, such that even after the war, the Second World War, there was this mentality that the depression might come back and the fear of more unemployment, the fear of mass unemployment. So we had a very interesting experiment there. We had to actually use a deflationary situation because we couldn't engage in public works and deficit financing because we had already borrowed to the hilt. States had borrowed money from London, and the last thing on their mind was to do more public works. The Scullin government was annihilated in the end of 1931, even though it did all the hard yakka, all the hard surgery, the reconstruction, etc. And maybe that might happen to Scott Morrison in 2 years when he has to put all these tax imposts on the people that have elected him.
Now, Alex,
so there's a marvelous historical twist there, yes, an irony. Right.
Alex, a tricky question for you as we jump forward to the Second World War. Can you name all the seven dwarfs?
No, I can only name three. I can name Coombs, who's a famous name. I can name Roland Wilson.
Coombs, yes.
Roland Wilson. There was another one called Alan Brown. There was Sir John Crawford. That's four out of seven.
Henry Bland?
Henry Bland, yeah.
Frederick Sheridan?
He was in Defence Secretary, I think, yeah.
Richard
and
Randall?
The last one.
See, I've got
Richard
these written down for me. I'm cheating outrageously.
Yeah. But the big two were Coombs and Wilson.
Tell us why this matters.
Well, Coombs was probably the great public Keynesian. He was one that was the head of the Department of Post-War Reconstruction and then later on head of the Commonwealth Bank, although the Reserve Bank. And he was very much an ardent Keynesian. Wilson, who became head of the Treasury in 1951, was much more cautious. The Treasury had a much more long-run view of Australia's economic development. They weren't sort of, you know, pump-priming or boost short-term economic management, whereas Coombs was. Coombs served Whitlam, he served Menzies, he served Curtin and Chifley. So probably Coombs is the most public figure we identify with the Keynesian Revolution in Australia.
The really interesting thing about that Second World War reconstruction was that at a time when this country was still bracing potentially for invasion, at a time when that war was still red hot, we were starting to think about that post-war future.
Yes, even before the war, Curtin and Chifley did not want a repeat of the Great Depression. And so in 1942, I think Curtin authorized the commissioning of a white paper on full employment after the war. And a lot of economists who joined the public service were advising, actually wrote this white paper that became, it was called Full Employment in Australia, and they actually prepared it and, you know, all the caveats and the conditions. Curtin made some marginal comments, as did Chifley. And it was announced in May 1945. And its basic promise was to give every man and woman a job in Australia. In fact, the criticism of it was they went too far. They actually wanted more jobs than people. So they put the economy on a high plane, on a high level of economic activity, such that inflation stirred up in the post-war period. In the post-war period, it was inflation, not unemployment, that was the curse, the menace.
Into the 1970s, I mean, in this little Cook's tour of significant economic shocks, and in the 70s, of course, it was oil prices that was the problem. And far from a visitation from the ghost of Keynes, we had a visitation from Milton Friedman, who's sort of the anti-Keynes.
That's right. Milton Friedman always wanted to supplant Keynes. Friedman arrived here in March 1975 with the vaccine for this inflationary virus, which was the word they were using. And it was called monetarism, which is basically tight monetary control, which would lead to disinflation, which sounds a very painful medicine. Disinflation is just slowing the rate of price increase, slowing the rate of inflation. Just on the inflation, though, well, the oil prices were a great contributing factor. It was also in the 70s, we were in full employment, and there was some wages growth. Wages were rising. the CPI was going up and we were into this inflationary vortex. The yeah. oil price compounded it, and as did Whitlam's excessive spending in 1974, where the that budget of many hands led to too much inflationary pressure. Whitlam wanted to carry out his program of social welfare, etc., social reform, and it led to the economy being overstretched and leading to hyperinflation, double-digit inflation, which actually didn't demoralize people. It puzzled people why it was that prices were rising so quickly. Friedman comes along, financed by an Australian stockbroker, comes to Australia on a lecture tour, and he unleashes the vaccine that we're all waiting for. And this vaccine was called monetarism. And as I said, it basically was deflating the economy, putting the economy into sort of a slower rate of growth to kill the inflation bug.
And you want to be careful with that kind of activity, I suspect.
Yes, that's right. but basically, Friedman had come not so much to kill the inflation bug, but also to introduce Australia to neoliberalism, to free markets, to economic fundamentalism, to free trade, to a smaller role of the state. That's what the Friedman was all about, not so much monetarism. That was the platform.
And this, I mean, this is where this becomes interesting, because I mean, we survey these great moments in economic history, and we look at the response and the development of ideas around them. I mean, how do you see this current moment playing out, and what will that change about economic orthodoxy?
It's going to change economic orthodoxy, as Laura said. There will be books being written as we speak. Right, about this great economic shock, this somersault, the speed of which it's unfolding is incredible, one wonders. I think it's going to be a sea change in economic philosophy. I think people will see that the state has to come back in, that neoliberalism, we're seeing the death knell of neoliberalism at present. That's why I mentioned how the Marxists must be very sad that they can't have their conference next 2 weeks' time, because, you know, it's overcrowding. You know, you can't have more than 10 people in a room or whatever, because they actually think it might be the death knell of capitalism. I don't think it is. It's the death knell of neoliberalism. And so there is going to be a sea change in political and economic philosophy from it. And I think it might be long lasting. The other thing that's going to happen, though, is that we're going to be facing paying off the credit card for a whole generation. But that's justifiable, as I said, because we are saving people's lives, saving the economy. We're putting in a circuit breaker to stop that negative feedback loop where, you know, someone loses their job, they lose their house, etc. The property prices collapse. So the government's strategy is quite correct and quite Keynesian in a national emergency. It's justifiable, even though it's running up a huge credit bill.
Well, and that does suggest, just in closing, Alex, that this Keynesian moment isn't a thing which continues. This resolves the crisis. But after that will come, I suspect, a period of toughness and stringency and austerity.
I suspect you're right, because that's what happened with the GFC. For two years, there was a short-term revival of Keynes, and then two academic economists called Reinhardt and Rogoff said, if your public debt is growing, your growth rate will also be slowing. And so that paper had a very pernicious influence, because it basically spooked governments into cutting back, into going into austerity economics, cutting back public debt, cutting back expenditure, raising taxes, slowing down the economy, which was the end result. But the fear of the public debt was sown in policymakers' minds. And so we were stuck with what's called austerity economics. And that basically has been going on since the last 10 years in many countries.
Yes.
We may get a rerun of that mentality, you know, the fear of the public debt. We'll also get inflation. The inflation that Laura mentioned, by the way, will also reduce the size of that public debt to some extent. We'll let inflation rip to pick up. Inflation will go up, and that will reduce somewhat the scale of that humongous public debt that we are recruiting.
But perhaps all of that might be tempered with a public reappraisal of the role of government, of the role of the state.
Oh, yeah, definitely. That's definitely happening. This, as I said, I think neoliberalism has been knocked for 6 years. All the neoliberals have gone to ground. They've disappeared. And as I said, these are remarkably exciting times to be an economist.
Yes, I'm sure. I'll leave you to enjoy, savor that excitement of these times, Alex. I mean, this must bring joy to some. And thank you for walking us through. Thank you for walking us through. It's an extraordinary economic century, really, Alex Milmau, Associate Professor of Economics, Federation Business School in Melbourne. This is Late Night Live.